Well, does it appear we have everybody that we wish for in this first hearing? If so, Marshall, if you want to identify the panel, you may do so.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Bradfold, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals. And as I'm sure you're aware, if any technical issues arise during this time, our hostess will aid us in getting someone reconnected if necessary. Also, the marshal, who in a few moments when we start, you'll see he'll have his clock for the traditional 15 minutes for appellant's counsel and so forth. If at any time we have any trouble hearing or seeing, or both, worse yet, he will stop the clock and we'll make sure to wait until we're reconnected. Sometimes we've noticed in the past, if there's been a video issue but not audio, we've asked counsel to disconnect the video if we can still hear the audio, which obviously is most important, but we'll attempt to do it this way as best we can. Also, I notice everybody is muted, and that is beneficial as well, other than when you're talking, of course, so that it might assist in minimizing any interference that we have. And as I say, the marshal will identify the time for you. Let us know, obviously, if you cannot see that. We do ask, just like in the courtroom, that when counsel begins, if you would identify yourself for the record proceed accordingly. And I'll just note for the record, this first matter, one of two oral calendar matters we have this afternoon, September 9. The first matter, A200158, George Matanis is the appellant, Abbott Laboratories et al., St. Jude Medical respondent. And so unless there's any questions about the technology from either counsel, if counsel for appellant, you wish to identify yourself and begin, you may proceed.
Can the court hear me okay before I start?
I'm seeing nodding, and yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Laura Farley, and I represent Appellant George Matanis. At issue today is the district court's order granting summary judgment and dismissing Mr. Matanis' claim against his longtime employer, respondent St. Jude or Abbott, for age discrimination under the New York City human rights law. There are several foundational errors underlying the district court's order that give rise to this appeal, three of which I'd like to discuss today. First, after correctly finding that Mr. Matanis had established his prima facie case of age discrimination, in part because of the comments made by his supervisors, the court disregarded this finding in later analysis. Second, the order failed to consider the evidence as a whole, let alone in favor of Mr. Matanis as the non-moving party, especially as it relates to its analysis of Mr. Matanis' pretext argument. Third, the order failed to make a meaningful mixed motive analysis, as it must under the New York City human rights law, which had the effect of overlooking several questions of material fact. For these reasons, this court should reverse summary judgment and allow a jury to decide whether St. Jude Medical discriminated against Mr. Matanis on account of his age. In the first instance, the district court's order correctly holds that Mr. Matanis established his prima facie case of age discrimination. This is the first step of both McDonnell-Douglas and the less stringent mixed motive analysis, which are both required under the New York City human rights law. The court found that Mr. Matanis had established his prima facie case because he was a member of a protected class as he was 66 years old at the time of his termination. He was qualified for his position in that he worked in medical device sales for over 30 years, and decades of which had been at St. Jude or predecessor companies. Mr. Matanis suffered an adverse action in that he was terminated as part of a reduction in force at St. Jude. And the court finally found that his termination occurred under circumstances which gave rise to an inference of age discrimination. Specifically, the court found that there were three reasons why Mr. Matanis' termination gave rise to an inference of discrimination. The first was that 78.6% of the individuals impacted by this particular reduction in force were over the age of 40 years old. The second was that his supervisors made ageist comments. And the third is that the timing of these comments in relation to the elimination of his position gave rise to that inference of discrimination.
Ms. Farley, could I ask you to jump, as the briefing seemed to suggest, that the first two prongs or factors of McDonnell Douglas seem largely not to be in dispute, or at least not hotly disputed, shall we say, and neither party seems to suggest that that end result might hinge on those two factors. So my question for you, I'm in attempting to better understand just exactly legally how different the New York City Human Rights Act mixed motive a factor, we'll call it factor 3A perhaps, is. Do you, hypothetically, if we were to look at the record and say, well, it appears to us the record supports the judge's dismissal under the traditional factor 3 and McDonnell Douglas, is it possible in your mind, given the specific reason proffered, which appears to be a poor performance, that that same record could therefore nevertheless support a reversal on the issue solely of mixed motive? Or do you believe it's an all or nothing if you disagree with that? And if so, under either way, why?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Mentonas could establish that he, under the mixed motive analysis, under that kind of third prong, it could still be true, and the court or a jury could accept as true St. Jude's asserted reason for termination, which was his sales performance based on that raw sales data. That could be considered true, and Mr. Mentonas could still survive summary judgment and prove his claims of discrimination, because under a mixed motive analysis, a discriminatory and non-discriminatory reason for termination are not mutually exclusive. So put another way, even if Mr. Mentonas was terminated because of that performance issue that the court referenced, he could still prove that at least in part, his termination was because of a discriminatory motive, which was based on his age. And that doesn't have to be the primary motive. It can be even just a small part of the reason. But if it is any part of the reason in which he was terminated, that alone is enough to prove his claims under the mixed motive analysis under the New York City human rights law.
Do you have or can you point to the record what specific facts that would suggest, on one hand, that it was not pretextual, which from the Bennett case and others means the explanation is complete. It's not, it has no mixed motive, or it has no motive of discriminatory intent, but notwithstanding that, could still have a mixed motive. What facts would you point to, perhaps the district court missed or glossed over when it did the mixed motive analysis after having done or already completed the traditional McDonnell Douglas third prong pretextual analysis?
There are essentially two facts, Your Honor, that I think go to, or two kind of categories of facts that go to your question. And they are both the comments that were made by Mr. Mentonas' supervisors, as well as the chronology of what happened, and considering the evidence that the court did, but placing it into the timeline as it occurred during the last year of Mr. Mentonas's employment at St. Jude. So in relation to the comments, Mr. Mentonas faced a number of comments from supervisors and from leadership related to his age. Those are from his supervisors, Mr. Arancio and Mr. Neistat, saying that he was aging in his position, asking him why he wants to keep carrying the bag, which is a industry term for keep doing the job. And then Mr. Bob Belosi as well, who was the hierarchical superior of Mr. Arancio and Mr. Neistat and the ultimate decision maker, who took him aside during a meeting and noted to Mr. Mentonas that, asking him questions, although they had never met before, why he wouldn't want to spend time with his grandchildren, why he would want to keep working, how long he had been in the industry. These age-related questions are evidence of discrimination under the mixed motive analysis. And it's important to note too that these same comments, the court found that those comments were part of the reasons why Mr. Mentonas was able to prove his prima facie case. Mr. Mentonas's supervisors, those comments, that was one of the three reasons why there was an inference of discrimination in the first instance under Mr. Mentonas's prima facie case. And the court cannot rely on these comments to find an inference of discrimination, but then decide that these same comments cannot be used as evidence of discrimination under the mixed motive standard. And there are, I'm not aware of any cases, and respondent doesn't point to any cases that stand for any type of proposition, but that the New York City human rights law, that a court can explicitly find that comments were discriminatory for purposes of the prima facie case, but not for purposes of proving discrimination under a mixed motive analysis. I'm not aware of any case that would support that reasoning, but rather the law supports that the comments need to be considered on both the prima facie case and again in the mixed motive analysis.
Ms. Farley, the district court concluded that the comments were stray remarks. How did the district court err in that conclusion?
In other words, the
comments that you're suggesting constituted the prima facie case, in its review of whether there was a mixed motive, the district court concluded that those were stray remarks and didn't provide evidence of a mixed motive.
Correct, Your Honor. And those comments that were categorized as stray remarks were incorrectly categorized as such. The court focused in on each comment specifically, standing on its own, if that could be considered a discriminatory comment. And the proper analysis should include the totality of the circumstances. A lot of these comments were made to Mr. Mantones on multiple occasions, not just the one time where it would be a stray remark, but rather many of the comments were made on multiple occasions, particularly asking Mr. Mantones, why he wanted to keep carrying the bag and stating that he was aging in his position. Moreover, it's not proper to consider whether the comments are offensive or whether or not those comments have any type of animus. Rather, if those comments are based in age and show that the decision makers were biased and had open declarations of bias related to Mr. Mantones' age, that alone is enough. It's not a matter of the offensiveness, but rather if the decision maker was motivated by assumptions or attitudes related to Mr. Mantones' protected class as an individual over 40 years old.
Ms. Farley, if I could, sorry. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Cochran. I am going to follow up on your question, so maybe we're thinking the same thing.
Go ahead, we probably
I'll give
are.
It a shot. So, Ms. Farley, I'd like you to comment on that a little bit more, because you're saying, I think, that the stray remarks do have to be shown to, you're saying they aren't stray remarks, first of all. And then secondly, you're saying that we should look at them in the totality. But I guess what the part I'm missing is totality to prove what? Says when I see, for instance, the Godbolt case, it suggests to me that the stray remarks do have to have a nexus or a connection to the discharge decision. And as I read the district court's decision, it's not that he didn't consider the stray remarks, it's that when he looked at them in the timeline, he found them not to be connected to the discharge decision. So if you would address that nexus requirement, and maybe you disagree that it's a requirement, go right ahead. Tell me about that.
I would disagree that it's a necessity for that nexus needs to exist, at least as I'm understanding your question. Because again, these are all decision makers making comments that show an open declaration of bias against Mr. Mantones as the oldest sales representative in that region. And in regards to the nexus, as far as how it relates to the decision to terminate Mr. Mantones, what's difficult in answering this question is that the district court's order does not answer the material question as to when Mr. Mantones was included in the reduction in force and chosen to be terminated as a part of that reduction in force. The record reflects that the decision was made in either March or April of 2017, which was the end of quarter one, or that the decision was made in August of 2017. And if the decision was made in August, then Mr. Bellosi made his comments at that meeting, which I referenced earlier, within weeks of his decision to include Mr. Mentonas in the reduction in force, which the proximity of which is relevant to that nexus question.
Well, I guess I don't, again, I appreciate this as summary judgment and you're entitled to all favorable inferences, but the meeting with Mr., is it Bellosi, something like that? So the meeting with Mr. Bellosi is, I think, August 28th, which is what, a week before Mr. Mentonas is discharged. So if you take Mr. Arancini's testimony about the timing of the reduction in force, the most favorable light to you, to Mr. Mentonas, it still puts the decision for reduction in force to be before the conversation over beers with Mr. Bellosi. So, I mean, at least that conversation, it seems to me, the district court had a basis for saying, you know, you don't have a nexus.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if that is the case, if it is August, then those comments still show Mr. Bellosi's state of mind. He's thinking of Mr. Mentonas in terms of the fact that he's the oldest sales representative in his group. He's thinking of Mr. Mentonas in the fact that, why is he still working? Shouldn't he be spending more time with his grandchildren? These are all stereotypical attitudes towards people of Mr. Mentonas's age, which were inappropriate and showed that Mr. Bellosi had those considerations in mind almost simultaneous. Had it been 2 weeks earlier, 2 weeks later, he still had those thoughts regarding Mr. Mentonas as it related to his employment. And those types of biased remarks are simply not stray remarks. They are related to Mr. Bellosi's considerations of Mr. Mentonas and whether or not he should or should not be included in the reduction in force. And to circle back as well, if the decision was made in March or April, the testimony that Mr. Bellosi says regarding that there were lots of reasons to include Mr. Mentonas in the reduction in force, those reasons were, as noted in the briefing, didn't necessarily exist at the time in which Mr. Mentonas would have been included in the reduction of force in March. So it's not necessarily that August is the most favorable to Mr. Mentonas. In either case, Mr. Mentonas can show that he had been discriminated against in his inclusion in the reduction in force.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Farley. And of course, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose. And so we'll turn to counsel for respondent. And if you would identify yourself first, then you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jolynn Markison, and I am counsel for the defendant appellee, St. Jude Medical. Your Honors, we are here today because St. Jude decided to eliminate Mr. Mentonas's position in a cost-saving reduction in force. Tasked with the directive to reduce costs with minimal business disruption, John Arancio, Mentonas's supervisor, and Arancio's supervisor, Bob Bielsi, did what anybody would do. They looked for the sales rep who was generating the least amount of revenue for St. Jude, and they chose to eliminate that position. Out of all the sales reps in the North Atlantic area, Mentonas's revenue was by far the lowest. Although this is undisputed.
Counsel, Ms. Markison, on page 9 of your brief, it shows that there was a salesperson who had lower revenue, that was a newer sales rep, but I think you said it was by far the lowest. I'm not sure that's exactly accurate. And wasn't appellant new to the company at that time? In other words, he had left the company and came back, so he was reestablishing his relationships. He wasn't in the same position as all the other established sales reps.
He was in the same position as the other established sales rep. He had a whole industry of experience behind him, years of experience behind him. The other individual, his sales figures were actually still lower than Mentonas's, I believe. Not significantly, but I believe they were st- still lower.
They were lower, but I think they're you said his lower. Mentonuses were by far the lowest of any, and I'm just trying to clarify the record here.
Your Honor, you've got me. So
well, that, I'm not trying to get you. I'm just trying to make sure we're all on the same page and understanding. That,
yes. So that individual was brand new
in relation to the other representatives.
Yes. That individual was brand new to the industry. He had no prior experience as a sales rep versus Mr. Mentonas, who had years and years of experience as a sales rep. And so with respect to that individual, the circumstances were vastly different.
Thank you.
Yes. Nonetheless, while it is disputed that his sales were on average lower than the other sales reps, he accuses Arancio and Biolsi of discrimination. And opposing counsel has left out three really critical facts that figured prominently into the district court's order. So opposing counsel fails to mention that Arancio had spent a good chunk of his prior year lobbying to get Mentonas back on board with St. Jude, months and months of trying to get him back into the company. At the time, Mr. Mentonas was 65 years old. Many of the comments and that we're talking about and that opposing counsel cites to were made in that context. So the reduction in force occurred 10 months after he was brought back on. He was roughly the same age as he was when they hired him, knowing how old he was. Second, opposing counsel ignores that Biolsi is close in age and is actually just a few years younger than Mentonas. So they actually are age peers. And finally,
can you clarify how old?
Biolsi was 59 at the time he had the conversation with Mentonas in New York in August of 2017.
Thank you.
Finally, along with Mentonas, Arancio and Biolsi also recommended eliminating the position of another individual who was 34 years old. So this isn't a situation where they've targeted one person who is in a protected age class. They actually chose two people who they determined would have minimal business disruption and eliminated both of those positions. The district court correctly found that Mr. Mentonas had not raised a genuine issue on the issue of pretext or on the issue of motivating factor. And
Ms. Markison,
because those decisions,
on that point, and perhaps a similar question I asked Ms. Farley, are you able to explain from the record, I'm assuming and all parties agree that the New York City standard is more lenient. So what I'm trying to understand is how much more lenient as applied to our facts. And part of what we've been asking about are these comments, whether they're considered stray or not, and a number of factors. Would it be safe to say that by more lenient, that would mean perhaps when there's a dispute factually, and if we're considering the evidence more favorable to the plaintiff, at least as to the New York City, I'll call it again, a 3A factor of mixed motive, would that not be a jury determination as to whether those sorts of statements and all these factors together form at least in part an age discrimination basis?
No, Your Honor. So the New York courts, this is definitely a more liberal statute. That is clear. This is a more liberal statute than Title VII or the Minnesota Human Rights Act. But where it really is more liberal is with respect to the prima facie case. There's an extremely low burden with showing a prima facie case. And in a lot of instances, courts will just assume that that's been made and move on to the rest of the inquiry. But once a defendant like St. Jude has come back with a legitimate reason that was non-discriminatory for the termination, that prima facie case falls away. And at that point in time, New York courts are very explicit that the burden of proving either pretext or mixed motive under the motivating factor analysis is frequently, quote, onerous. And even cases that the plaintiff has cited recognize this. And I'll give you a couple sites. So the Bennett versus Health Management Systems is explicit on this point. And that's one of the cases that were reiterated as being correctly decided with the 2016 amendments to the New York City Human Rights Law. Also, Melman versus Montefiore, which we cite in our case, also supports that proposition.
Ms. Markinson, where yes. Can you quote me the language in Bennett? I have it before me. I just want to understand what you're referring to.
So the language in, I don't have the exact language of Bennett in front of me, but it's that the, unlike the intended role for a de minimis prima facie showing, the task of challenging a defendant's proffered non-discriminatory reasons can frequently be onerous.
And what page
is
that on?
And that's specific in the context. In the case, that is on page 119.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Counsel said she's not aware of any cases where a court has found that certain statements were sufficient to make a prima facie case, but were found to be not sufficient to satisfy the motivating factor. And I can cite you two. And they are cases that she relied on. The first one is ICA versus Brookdale Hospital Medical Center. It's an Eastern District of New York case. The second case is Lowe versus Mount Sinai Health System, also a Southern District of New York case out from 2018. In both of those cases, the statements at issue were by far more based on protected status than the statements we have in this case. The court found that they were sufficient for a prima facie case, but not sufficient to satisfy the motivating factor analysis. With respect to the actual statements that we have in this case, I think it's important to understand what we're dealing with. We're talking about two potential decision makers, even crediting things in the light most favorable to Mentonas. We're talking about Arancio and Biolsi. Statements made by NYSTAD or by random people who the plaintiff hasn't bothered to name or provide any timeframes on, to the effect of, do you still want to do this? Do you still want to carry the bag? Are you here again? Those types of statements by non-decision makers unrelated to the decisional process are properly characterized as stray remarks. And the court recognized that and credited it. So we're really looking at Arancio and Biolsi. With respect to Arancio, the statements aren't quite what opposing counsel would have you believe. There was a statement in an evaluation that Arancio made to the effect that Mentonas was a very senior sales rep and he hoped that he would mentor younger associates. On its face, this relates to industry experience, not to age. And this occurred 5 months after Arancio rehired Mentonas. And so there is, based on case law, there is a presumption against discrimination for statements made because Arancio was the same person who had lobbied for and hired Mentonas. So the same actor inference applies to him. And it's a substantial hurdle to overcome that to show that he actually was age biased.
So, counsel, I'd like to ask you about that same actor principle rule doctrine. In case law, first of all, I appreciate we are applying the New York human rights law. Has there case law that suggests that issue, you know, the same actor issue, actually should go to the jury? Because it really is an evaluation of the degree to which the comments are evidence of motive, as opposed to what you are now arguing they could be. It's a very reasonable interpretation of Mr. Arancino's arguments or statements, but it might not be the interpretation the jury gives it. And that's, I just want to understand what the case law says we do with that. And again, keeping in mind that he isn't the same age as Mr. Mentonas. He's 48, not 65.
Right, and that's a different, I'm not
different
arguing
issue.
That
I understand.
It's a different, yes. So, Your Honor, if he was able to come forward with sufficient evidence to show that notwithstanding the inference, there were comments made or actions taken that were so egregious that it overcame the inference, then that's something that would go to the jury. But in a situation like this, the comments themselves aren't sufficient in and of themselves, not even considering the same actor inference, to rise to the level of raising a jury question. And I can give you Coleman versus Trump International Hotel and Tower and Leon versus Columbia University Medical Center, which we cite on page 18 of our brief. And we also cite a bunch of cases in footnote 8 on page 30, showing that this is not something that should go to the jury.
Ms. Markinson, can I follow up on that? Here there was more than one decision maker, though. So doesn't that factor into whether the same actor principle should be applied. In other words, if there was only one decision maker, I can see it not going to the jury, but where there's more than one decision maker involved, Bellosi and Arencio, why shouldn't it go to the jury given that both decision makers made comments about age?
So it allegedly applies to Arencio. It applies to Arencio, not Biolsi. Biolsi right. has his own inference against discrimination based on the fact that he is similar in age to Mr. Mentonas. And also there are other inferences as well.
But these are inferences. I guess the trouble I'm having is understanding why it shouldn't go to the jury, just simply based on an inference.
So it's not just based on the inference, it's based on the comments themselves. So I want to address specifically this allegation that Arencio and Biolsi or anybody else said Mr. Mentonas was aging in his position. When he was pressed during his deposition, Mentonas backed off of that. That's an allegation that he has in his complaint. He backed off of it and said, well, what they actually did was here was the shtick. They said, you still here, you still want to do this. And he wouldn't confirm in his deposition that they in fact said, quote, you're aging in your position. With respect well, to Biolsi's,
but we also have, so in his deposition, appellant said, with regard to, sorry, I have the wrong page, Arencio, in response to a question on page 146, he said, the question was, so did you tell Mr. Arencio that the reason you believe you didn't get coverage was because of your age? And he said, yes. And then he said, do you really want to work this hard at this stage in your life? And he said, yes. I'm sorry, I'm not finding the exact quote I was looking for, but it seemed to me that there was some reference to working hard at this stage in your life, which could be considered viewed in the light most favorable to him to be an ageist comment.
I think, Your Honor, when we compare it to the case law out of New York, which we should do for guidance, statements like that aren't sufficient. Those comments, there's no dispute they weren't related to the decision itself. They were made also in the context of this was somebody that Arencio had put his own reputation on the line to bring back to the company, and his sales weren't cutting it. He was barely making enough money to support his own salary, let alone be beneficial to the company. In addition, if you look at the conversation between Mentonas and Biolsi that happened, this is a conversation between two age peers. Case law is clear that retirement conversations like that aren't evidence of discrimination. And finally, I want to put to bed this notion that we don't know when the decision was made, because we've submitted an undisputed piece of evidence, docket index 67, which is a May 2017 spreadsheet listing Mr. Mentonas for inclusion in the RIF with everybody else. So there is no dispute that at least by May 2017, he was to be included in the RIF. Your Honor, while it is true that the New York human rights law is to be construed liberally, it is not limitless. And Mr. Mentonas, even viewing the statements and the evidence in the light most favorable to him, has not satisfied his burden of showing that age was a motivating factor. The judge looked at the totality of everything and correctly concluded that even considering all of it, there simply was no nexus between any of those statements and the decision itself. St. Jude respectfully requests that you affirm the trial court's grant of summary judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Markison. And Ms. Farley, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you may proceed as soon as you see the clock in front of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by addressing those three facts that counsel noted that I hadn't referenced. To be clear, Orancio did recruit Mr. Mentonas back, but that fact alone does not establish that Orancio could not also be discriminatory against Mr. Mentonas. They brought him back to get his book of business back, which was $432,000 based on financial records on the from St. Jude. And once they had that, they got rid of him. The fact that Orancio brought him back is also belied by the fact that Mr. Bellosi was hired after Mr. Mentonas was. So Mr. Mentonas is hired by Mr. Orancio in October. And then I think it's a month later about Mr. Bellosi has hired. And that intervening event is critical when considering this same actor defense, which even in itself is not dispositive. I believe the Schreiber v. WorldCo case that we cite in our briefing shows that that is not dispositive in itself. And cutting this up between an inference regarding Orancio and then another inference regarding Bellosi and then a number of inferences regarding the timing of everything isn't looking at the totality of the circumstances. Everything needs to be considered together, and that Bellosi and Mentonas were 7 years apart also is not an inference that can stand alone for eliminating Mr. Bellosi's discriminatory comments against Mr. Mentonas. And that they were close in age, again, just is not dispositive. And the Danzer v. Norden System case out of the Second Circuit, again, cited in our brief, holds that type of proposition is patently untenable to say that you can't discriminate against someone in your own protected class. The third fact that Ms. Markison noted was that another individual was much younger. She was 34, was included in the reduction in force. That individual isn't a comparison or a comparator for purposes of employment discrimination cases. She had a different position. She was not measured under the same metrics. She was a technical sales specialist, which essentially is an assistant to the sales representatives.
Also, you would agree, though, that appellant's sales were, with the exception of the new salesperson, were far below, sales revenue was far below that of the other sales representatives in the region for the time period that was being looked at.
Yes, Your Honor, in regards to raw data.
Okay. So given that, going back to the nexus question, what is the nexus between the ageist comments, which are not that extensive in the record, as far as I can tell, and the reduction in workforce decision, which Ms. Markinson argued was made on May 27th. She says that the record is clear, it's undisputed that there's a May 27th worksheet that includes the reduction in workforce names.
Sure, Your Honor. So taking that May document, that creates problems for Mr. Bellosi's testimony as the main decision maker in including Mr. Mentonas in the reduction in force, because Mr. Bellosi testified that there were a number of reasons why Mr. Mentonas was included in the reduction in force. And that's the quote that the court includes in its order. And it's related to the letter of expectation and this alleged promise to bring back $1 million. And that letter of expectation, again, was not drafted by the time that May exhibit that counsel referenced was there. And in any event, the record also supports that it wasn't May, but it was March in which Mr. Mentonas was included in the reduction in force, the end of March. And at that time, there had only been about a month's worth of sales performance data that could have been available to Mr. Bellosi or Mr. Orancio, and the letter of expectation did not exist. Further, as we've discussed it at length in our briefing, St. Jude, for purposes of this litigation, have chosen one of the many reasons that are on the record for including Mr. Mentonas in the reduction in force, because that, looking just at the raw data, ignores the fact that Mr. Mentonas was on track to meet his quota that St. Jude set for him at $500,000. That was St. Jude's expectation of Mr. Mentonas. And so whether or not it was the lowest isn't necessarily at issue. If you're looking at the totality of what Mr. Mentonas was judged and evaluated on as a sales representative at St. Jude.
Is there any case law that supports that view? In other words, that the company had to make its decision based on quotas rather than raw sales numbers?
Not a quote necessarily, Your Honor, but or a case that supports that. But St. Jude testified in the corporate representative deposition, Mr. Bellosi testified that is how they evaluate sales representatives. And in any event, even under the mixed motive analysis, it can still be true that he had the lowest raw sales data in his region and they still discriminated against him under the New York City human rights law.
Thank you to both counsel. Time has expired. We appreciate your additional comments today, and we will be issuing an order in the statutory period. We continue to hear you well and see you as well, so that all worked out well, and each of you have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.